This is Power Athlete Radio. With your host, Denny Kaye, Professor Booty, and the Luke Summers. And now, toes forward, hips locked, shoulders set, and retract those scapulas. It's time for some knowledge bombs.
Thanks for tuning in to Power Athlete Radio. This week, we welcome the owner of Jim Laird Strength and Conditioning and once roommate of Jim Wendler. The former powerlifter turned industry leader has some unconventional opinions about, well, just about everything. After some discussion on Jim's background, we get down and dirty with his fascinations of optimal posture, high versus low threshold environments, and the power of meditation. Learn how his life took some interesting turns and conscious reprioritizing after struggling with a major health setback. His brutally honest take on the experience and its possible link to a lifestyle of poor eating, excessive training, and steroid use is sobering to say the least. Next, we chat about his typical client. Working with nearly 90% females, Jim has developed a unique finesse to converting your average cardio fiend or triathlete into a competitive powerlifter. How does he do it? The secrets lie just moments away. Jim Laird is not your average coach. Our candid conversation revealed his unique approach to athlete assessments, vision for the future of our industry, and insight to what really matters in training and in life. This is episode 106.
What's up, Power Athlete Nation? Welcome to another episode of the premier podcast in strength and conditioning, and valuable resource in teaching you how to become the hammer and not the nail, Power Athlete Radio. This is Denny. Today we got John, Luke, Tex, and Callie, and Mr. Steven Playtech, Prof. Booty. And our guest is Jim Laird. How's it going, Jim? Thanks for joining us.
Great. Thank you. I really appreciate having me on. I don't think I've ever been on a show with this many people at the same time.
We're getting up there. We're getting up there.
We'll have a couple more join later.
Yeah.
Keep it, make it a little variety.
Jim, Jim's working as a strength and conditioning coach since 97. You got about 4 years in Division I coaching, and you've worked with athletes on NFL, MLB, LPGA,
Andy has his own podcast. Don't think we didn't know you're in direct competition with Power Athlete Radio.
Wait, I haven't done one in a while, so.
Well, you know what? We talked a little bit earlier. You got a really unique approach to how you train your athletes. It kind of reminds me a little bit of like Mike Metzer. When he started training some of his clients after his bodybuilding days, he kind of took this less is more approach.
Sure.
Where he was training people maybe two times a week for like 30, 40 minutes, and they were making huge gains. Mm-hmm. So maybe we could just kind of start to show off a little bit about your history.
Sure.
You had some really great powerlifting experience, and then we can kind of go into like your approach and the whole what we were talking about, like high threshold versus low threshold.
Sounds good.
Awesome.
I grew up in Canada originally. I played everything from hockey, football, wrestling. For some reason, I'm 5'9", I weigh about 250 pounds. And for some reason, I wanted to play football in the United States. And my wrestling coach thought I was absolutely insane because I went from competing with probably 40 people in the world to like, you know, 300,000 or 400,000 for a position that was, you know, dying. I was a blocking fullback. And so I went to a JUCO in California, in Redding, California, and played there for a year. Then I transferred to Liberty, and that's when I kind of got into the – I'd always lifted weights and always done that sort of thing because I really enjoyed it. But that's when I kind of realized that I could actually make a career out of this, because other than like guys like Charlie Francis in Canada, there just wasn't, you know, strength and conditioning. And then I ended up going to Arizona where I met Jim Windler. And that's how I ended up here in Kentucky. But, you know, I met Jim, and Jim's kind of the guy that got me into powerlifting, and I competed for about 8 to 10 years and total lead a number of times and had a really good time, learned a lot about that. Worked as an independent contractor at a gym here in Lexington and for till about 2008. Worked with every kind of athlete you could imagine. Mostly now I deal mainly with normal everyday people, and I get to cherry pick my athletes. But then in 2008, I left the facility I was working at and decided to open my own place, because I just saw a void. I just saw this this need for basically teaching people the difference between performance and health, and then also getting people to understand that if you want to train at a high level, if you want to compete at a high level, you have to put the rest and the nutrition and all of that and your general physical preparedness, that has to be your priority before you can start training really hard. Because there's a lot of people out there that are training really hard, but they don't take care of everything else. So a lot of times for me, it's getting people in and taking a look at where they're at and getting them to say, hey, you know, you really need to put more emphasis on sleep and nutrition and slowing down a little bit and chilling out, and that way you can train harder. So that's pretty much, you know, my approach as far as that goes.
Did you see that with like high level athletes as well? This I gotta go.
Oh yeah.
No, or is it just like the general pop?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think with the athletes, most of it is they've, especially now, like in the beginning when I first started, you know, when I went to Arizona, I thought, hey, I'm going to this great school and we're going to be able to do all these cool things in the weight room. And I realized very quickly Brad Arnett was there. We had some of the best athletes like Gilbert Arenas and, Luke Walton and people like Jenny Finch, but they couldn't do anything in the weight room. They were very, very subpar. And so I realized, you know, hey, even the best athletes, they really don't need anything beyond the basics. And a lot of them are doing training that's way beyond their ability. It's forcing them into thresholds and strategies that are a little bit beyond where they're at. So a lot of times it's backing people back a little bit and starting where they are. You know, you got somebody who's, you know, hasn't even finished middle school and you're trying to get at their PhD. It's not really going to work real well. So a lot of times with the normal everyday people, most of the people that come to me are highly successful. They've got kids, they've got jobs, they're running around like a chicken with their head cut off. They're doing spinning class, they're doing triathlons, and their goal is just to look good and feel better. They just want to look better in a bathing suit, and they want to be able to play with their kids. And they're out there training like a professional athlete, doing all these different things. And it's like, hey, you know, you really don't need to do that much if you just want to look good and feel better. You know, it's lift some weights, walk, eat good food, get some sleep, take some more time for yourself, have some fun, enjoy yourself, and relax. And so I thought I needed to re-educate, because most of the times most of the people that come to us, they've already gone to 5 or 6 different facilities. And every answer for people that are trying to lose fat is, well, we need to do more. We need to do more. We need to do more. And for most of the people, it's you need to take some of your time that you're going to the gym, and you need to cook your food, and then you need to sleep, and you need to do these other things. And then all of a sudden, they get healthier, and all of a sudden they lose body fat instead of trying to beat it off them, you know, with a stick, you know?
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
Sure.
Yeah, so I was just curious. I mean, we've talked with some sleep doctors and nutritionists, mm-hmm. and people, you know, also in your realm of strength and conditioning. And one thing that we've found is that there seems to be a society that we live in now that sort of glamorizes the idea of running yourself ragged, right?
Yes.
And so we almost hold that up on a pedestal, like, look at these CEOs or look at these high-end athletes, look at these guys who are doing 3 days and like, and, sure. and what, number one is we really don't even know actually what they're doing. We just know what we're told that they're doing. And number two, who was it? Herschel Walker, who ate one meal a day or something like that. You have all of these crazy, almost extreme, I don't know, protocols that people think are going to make them successful. And part of it is just like that when we see that being held up on a pedestal, we think that if we're not doing those things, or if you are spending your time sleeping those 8 hours and not the 4 hours that the CEO is sleeping, then somehow you're not living up to your own potential. So do you run into that kind of mentality with the athletes that you work with?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it has a lot to do with Western philosophy. You know, you got the Protestant work ethic. You got to work harder. You got to work from 9 in the morning till you know, the sun goes down. And then we look at outliers like Herschel Walker. You know, we try and compare ourselves to them. Maybe John can, but, you know, I definitely can't. But, you know, that was kind of a joke. But, you know, it's funny because, you know, Dr. Kurt Parsley is a good friend of Rob Wolf's. He was a doctor for the SEALs.
And, we had him on
these guys are the toughest of the toughest, and most of them end up in his office with the testosterone level of an 8-year-old girl, you know, because they've run themselves so hard into the ground and they're so high threshold, they can't function a normal everyday life. So a lot of times we have people, they can't relax, and the only way they feel good is when they're killing themselves doing a spinning class. You know, so I think a lot of it is Western culture. And, you know, if you teach people, and I ran into this too, I ran myself into the ground. That's one of the reasons I got into what I'm doing now, is because my training was fairly smart. It was the fact that I wasn't sleeping. I was working too much, and I ended up with ulcerative colitis, and then I ended up finding out I was a celiac. So I think a lot of the autoimmune conditions, this is just my opinion, a lot of the autoimmune conditions and a lot of the disease states that we see today that we didn't see in the past are due to a lot of this, like, going hard lifestyle. And even people that are sedentary, you know, with iPhones and stress and the amount of stress we have now, we have much more stress now, man-created stress, than we have in the past. People that are even don't do much exercise are stressed out, you know. So you get people that are coming to their gym, they eat like shit, they don't sleep, and their level of preparedness is zero, and then you throw them into whatever workout you put them into, boot camp, lose your fat in 3 weeks, and you bury most of the people. And then out of that, maybe two people get results, and of course they're on the testimonial page, but the other 80-90% of the people that you destroyed, oh, well, that's just the price you pay, you know, for the sport you play.
Yeah, so we had on Dr. Kirk Parsley, and so I can definitely understand the sentiment that you're expressing, because the guy is he's super smart, obviously knows the extremes of that environment, especially with the special forces firsthand. And if anybody has not listened to his TED Talk, get out there and do it. It's great. I have a question for you. Regarding like the type of population that you work with on a daily basis, what is that like? I mean, what does your day look like?
Generally, I work with 90% of my clients are female, and I basically trick most of them from stopping running marathons and doing triathlons into switching into more of a strength training approach. And then I'm lucky enough that my business is very healthy on that end, and I can pick and choose the athletes I want to work with. So an athlete comes to me, I basically interview them, and I'm like, I want to work with you or I don't. So I'm very lucky on that end that I haven't built my business around training athletes, because today, you know, so many of the high schools have their own coaches. It's all year round sports. It's really hard to get a kid for enough time to actually do anything with them to make kind of a difference. You're mostly doing damage control. I have a group of ladies, got about 17 ladies getting ready for a meet here in the end of June. They're just normal women that just, I kind of tricked. We have a general class that we do that basically is basics and strength training. And then the ones that gravitate more towards deadlifts and stuff like that, I'm like, hey, why don't we, got about four or five of them about 4 years ago or 3 years ago decide they want to do a powerlifting meet. And it's just kind of gone viral since then. So we do two meets a year, and we train maybe, you know, 20 weeks a year for powerlifting, and the rest of the time it's more athletic type stuff. And we do that like twice a year, so we got that in June. But today, you know, my busy days are Tuesday, Thursday. Tuesday, Thursdays I work from 6:30 in the morning till about noon. And I have a break from noon to 3:30, and then I work from 3:30 till about 7. I work in the evenings every night, and then I have a half day Saturday. So I'm working with, you know, today I've already trained, you know, what most people would train in a full day. I've already worked with this morning. We have a class in the morning, and then I work in groups of like 4 to 6 throughout the day. So, you know, I'm working with, and that's what I like it. I mean, that's how I started as a strength coach at Arizona. We were working with 100 kids at a time. at Liberty, heck, we had to work with every team. Same with Arizona. When I was there, there was only like 4 or 5 coaches. And at Liberty, there was 3 of us. So, you know, I worked with every sports team from 6 in the morning till 6 at night. And that's probably one of the reasons I crashed and burned, because I'm addicted to working so hard. But I've had to put a lot of effort into meditation and slowing down for myself to keep myself healthy. But, you know, it's people don't understand the amount of energy that it requires to be a good coach, because you have to be so attentive and you have to actually care about the people you're training. And that just wears you out. And I'm very lucky. I have some amazing staff. It's taken me about 5 years to get some staff that I really, really enjoy. And they allow me to have some much needed days off where I can go fishing and do stuff like that and chill out and relax.
So you are a very busy man, and I will admittedly tell you that I completely baited you into that question, because upon my research of you, I noticed that you almost exclusively work with babes, and that that definitely piqued my interest, and I was just, you know, wondered why you gravitated towards the fairer sex in terms of specifically powerlifting and training female athletes.
Well, one, they're easily coachable. Two, they get really quick results if you do real work with them and you
set
them up.
So you can just like tell them what to do, basically, because they're
they don't have an ego. I don't have to act like a silverback gorilla.
Right.
They do really well in mentoring, and I do really well with athletes that want to mentor. I don't want to be one of those coaches that's a screaming kind of have to motivate kind of person. I want to be more of a guide and a teacher. So that's more of my coaching style. And they bring their friends. Like, if you get results, they bring their friends in. And then they're the most neglected group out there. It's one of the reasons I've done some seminars in the past exclusively on training women, because no one has really – all the information out there is mostly for training men. And so it just kind of was a perfect fit with my coaching style. And then it just was a no competition. I mean, I had a coach I was talking to yesterday, actually, who was he was really struggling. He was like, I've been trying to get this football team for 4 years and this wrestling team won't work with me. And I'm like, dude, like, you know how many girls soccer teams there are in your town? I guarantee if you go to the girls soccer team and you offer to work with them, they'd love it. You know, he's like, well, I never thought of that. I'm like, yeah, there's, you know, female athletes are probably the most neglected athlete there is. And guess what? Just some really simple strength training, some carries, some prowler pushes, and you can take a woman and take them from one of the slowest girls on the team to one of the faster girls on the team with little to low work at all. And you can't do that with a guy, you know.
Plus injury prevention.
Or go ahead, Tex.
I was going to say plus the injury prevention just with those
males. Yeah, absolutely. And the confidence part of it too. Yeah. Like what strength training does and getting women stronger, what it does for their confidence and their self-worth and self-esteem is absolutely unprecedented.
So let me ask you this. I mean, coaching and cueing and temperament and all that aside, and the fact that they mm-hmm. bring their friends and the fact that it makes them feel strong and they get stronger – physiologically, do you train the women differently to optimize their time with you, right? I mean, from a strength training perspective, is there anything different you're doing to drive adaptation in them that you maybe would not do for a man?
I probably work at a higher percentage more often. They can handle a little bit higher percentages once they've trained for a while. Of course, you know, the first year or two, anything works, you know, so I try and lay down good movement patterns and things like that, but they can handle more volume more often. Their nervous system doesn't take the beating that a guy's does. So you can do more things with them more often. And then I make sure I don't train like for powerlifting for too long, because the girls I train don't want to be powerlifters. They just like doing meets for fun. And so, I mean, even though we got 10 girls that pull over 300 pounds, they don't, after about 10 to 12 weeks of training for powerlifting, they really need to get away from that. So we get into some athletic stuff. We start, you know, throwing med balls and doing sprints and doing some different things to kind of pull them away from that, because most women after about 10 to 12 weeks of powerlifting, they just kind of start feeling blocky. That would be my assessment. And so we pull them away from that, and then we get away from that for about 6 to 8 weeks, and then we go right back into training for a meet again. So that would be the thing that that would make it different. They're really, you know, really a joy to train. And the guys that I train are a little different too. They're more teachable. Most of the guys I train don't have the huge ego that most guys do.
Yeah. I know that it sounds like the girls are doing it as almost like a hobby, and even yes. just kind of visiting your website and reading through some of your philosophies and getting an idea for the culture that your coaching style is like, or your gym is like, it seems to me that it's much more conducive to newer people or people who are like dipping a toe in and then trying to excel in the sport, as opposed sure. to like when you go to, I mean, ourselves, I can only throw us into like a very like cliche category of like skull and crossbones type thing, where you go to a website and it's all black and it's like, if your total isn't this, you can't enter this site. Go right. fucking kill yourself, you know. So, so I think like even from like a business standpoint and just from sort of like a social responsibility standpoint, I think it's awesome that you're making this sport accessible to people who otherwise would have the wrong interpretation of it. It's not all sure. cut off jeans and fucking flannel shirts, although there's nothing wrong with that. It can be for everyone.
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons I did it, is to show that women can you can play tennis and not compete at Wimbledon, you know? So that's one of the reasons we go to drug tested meets. We go to drug free meets. Cause I want to kind of keep the girl, not even though I competed in open meets and, you know, I smashed my head into the bar and I sniffed ammonia caps and all that kind of stuff. I want to keep them away from that side of the sport, you know, the dark side of the sport, which I'm perfectly fine with. If people want to do that stuff, that's their business. But for them, I want to show women that, hey, instead of going out and running a triathlon, you can do this powerlifting, and it's going to make you look to be the best version of you. It's going to help you with bone density. It's going to help you with confidence. You're only going to have to train like 3 days a week. It's going to help you with anti-aging. You're not going to run your body into the ground, because most of the women I see that come in are marathon runners and triathletes. It's like, whoa. It's like somebody hit the fast forward button on the aging button, you know? And so it just giving women a different option of like, hey, you can do this and you don't have to, you can work within your means. And, you know, the first couple meets they do, you know, they're working well within their means. I'm giving them a weight they can handle very, very easily. You know, and then once they've done a few meets, then we can start pushing things a little bit. But, you know, and we've got, they're very competitive. Don't get me wrong, but it's just a different kind of outlook. We're doing it more for the fun of the sport and for the camaraderie. I mean, there's nothing better than walking into a powerlifting meet with like 17 women. And, you know, they hit an outlet mall on the way up, and then we all go out to eat after. I mean, it's a lot of fun. You know, it's pretty cool. I really enjoy it. And, it's neat. It's, you know, some people would kind of be like, oh, dude, that you've sold out. Well, that's cool. I like my life. So I'm fine.
Yeah, that's great. Sorry to hijack this, template, Denny. Like if I derailed us temporarily.
I just have a quick question. Jim's been mentioning some great observations that he's learned throughout his coaching career. I just want to go back to when you first got into it and at the college level. And sure. curious, I know we talked a little bit about this at the summit, just kind of mm-hmm. over dinner.
Yes.
But just some kind of quick observations that you've learned and just held on to, kind of like that Gilbert Arenas, where not the best athlete, he's not the best in the weight room, but just some other observations that you've held on to.
Yeah, like Windler told me, you know, early on, be the best beginner coach possible. Because honestly, most people don't have the dedication, most people don't have the time, and most people never take it past really the beginner level. You know, I honestly, this is going to sound terrible, but you know, I only use probably 20 to 30% of my knowledge base on a daily basis, because most people that come to me just don't have. Even like Scott Downs, who I worked with, who just retired recently, 14 years in the majors. I got him just after his Tommy John. I worked with him for 10 years. You know, I only got him for 3 to 4 months, like 3 months in the off season, and it was just getting him back to baseline so he could survive the next year. You know, so it wasn't, you know, by the end of it, we could do some pretty cool stuff to help him keep his velocity up and stuff. But, you know, you really don't get to work with anybody for the most part. There are exceptions to that. I've got a pretty high MMA guy that I work with who's pretty freaky. I've been working with for 4 years, who has an awesome aerobic engine that we can do some really cool stuff with. But, you know, for the most part, especially when you're dealing with athletes that, you know, our system is so broken in this country. We don't have free play anymore. Kids don't do gymnastics. They don't move really well. So a lot of the stuff I'm doing with these kids is basic phys ed stuff. It's not really anything extraordinary, because they haven't learned these things, and we have to back up and kind of go, hey, well, you know, you're doing this and this and this, but you probably need to be doing this and this. So a lot of this is just being the best beginner coach possible and being the best teacher possible, because very rarely do I run into anybody where I really have to like study and stretch my knowledge base. I know it sounds kind of terrible, but I mean, it's the truth. I mean, most of the people that you're going to walk through your door as a strength coach are remedial. I had a guy on the other day that I was talking to. He's like, I want to train athletes. And I'm like, okay, dude, but good luck with that. You know, it's like you're not going to have – there's maybe – you know, a handful in Lexington, there's a handful of professional athletes, and most of them aren't even here year-round.
Dude, it's so true. But haven't you heard? Everyone's an athlete now, so it's okay.
And most of them are motor morons, too. There's a guy, Mark Hill was a strength coach at Kentucky when Windler was there, and he had one of the most epic quotes of all time. You can only polish a turd so much.
Oh, my God.
It's still a turd.
You know, it's true. I wanted to just kind of like agree with you, because it is true. We spend a lot of time expanding our knowledge base and being ready for, I think when we dive into these conversations on the podcast is really the time that we get to kind of nerd out the most and explore conversations like at a summit or at a seminar. That's when you really get to explore, dive deep within different training philosophies and methodologies. But yeah, I mean, if you can master the basics as a beginner coach, that's going to get you pretty fucking far, from a business standpoint and just from an effectiveness standpoint.
Absolutely. I agree completely. You know, I know you guys wanted to talk a little bit about the high threshold stuff, and, you know, a number of years ago, I started working with a guy named Bill Hartman and Mike Robertson up in Indianapolis, and they really kind of changed my perspective on training. And, you know, people have different strategies for doing movements. And so one of the things that happens when someone goes into a movement they're not really prepared to do, or the body basically will find ways to do things. And I think this is one of the reasons we're seeing so many like elbow injuries and ACL injuries. One of these compensation patterns is extension. Okay. So, you know, somebody's hard extended in a squat, or, you know, they're moving, or they're just, what happens is you end up with this scissor position where people's ribs are flared, they're in this bad position, and they start breathing through their neck, and they get tight traps and scalenes and all these sort of things. And we're seeing this a ton, especially with young kids. They've never played, they don't know how to move really well, or people even just walking around, they're using this survival, like extension is like a survival strategy to get stability. They're using this high threshold strategy to do very, very low level things, like putting someone in a bird dog on the floor. They're flexing their whole body because they just don't have this low level stability. And we're seeing kids that, you know, have been trained really, really hard, or 15, 16, and they can't stand on one foot. You know, so we do a basic assessment here. We do like an FMS. And the only reason we do an FMS is just to see if we have pain. And if we have pain, we have a physical therapist here that we send them to. Or if I have someone who's a high-level athlete, they get assessed by the PT as well. But we're seeing my assessment is basically how they move, how they skip, you know, what they can do. But I'm seeing people, especially kids, they're having to use these high-threshold emergency strategies to stand on one foot, you know. And that's okay if you're going into a high-threshold strategy like extension, pulling a world record on the deadlift, or if that's part of your sport, like if you're an Olympic lifter and you're doing the snatch and you're jacking your head back to get, you know, to do the snatch, that's perfectly fine. But can we shut that strategy off so it doesn't become your only strategy? Because the last thing you want to do is walk around jammed in extension all day, and that's a lot of what we see. You know, so a lot of the stuff we're doing with our breathing and our resets is pulling people out of that extension. Because if you're stuck in extension all day and you don't have that rib cage lined up with the belly button, you can't breathe very effectively. All of a sudden, you have to start using your neck and your traps and your scalenes and everything else to breathe, which isn't as efficient as using your diaphragm as your main breather. And then people don't recover, you know, and it's also a lot harder on the nervous system when you're using these really high threshold, you know, if you're doing a bodyweight squat and you have to throw your head back and go into extension, that's going to be a lot harder on you orthopedically and neurologically in the long run. So that's something that's kind of changed my perspective as time has gone on about, hey, that person's really, really strong, but how are they getting that strength? That I'm really worried about, hey, how is that person getting that stability or getting that strength? Is it something that's doable over the long term, or is it just something that's going to, you know, because if you're squatting in hard extension It might be great if you're in a multi-power, you know, ply powerlifting meet where you don't have to go to parallel. But if you're a raw squatter, you have to go deep. That's going to really take up your knees and your hips and everything else are going to take a beating because you're in a really bad position. And the same thing for overhead athletes. If you're stuck in extension, you're a pitcher, you're going to be in a bad position and you're going to have a hard time with your elbow.
Can you talk a little bit about meditation and the role that you feel it plays in either recovery or kind of just the training matrix of an athlete?
Yeah, absolutely. Like shutting off is so important.
Before we dive into Jim's meditative practices, Power Athlete HQ would like to take a moment to kindly remind you to eat the week. What does eat the week mean? Not a call for cannibalism, but a mindset to dominate. Total domination not only of your competitors, but of yourself. No one said it'd be easy. Conflict crafts character. Devour weakness, doubt, fear, and feeble excuses. Consume them before they consume you. Eat the week. To purchase your Eat the Week shirt now, go to shop.powerathletehq.com. Now back to the show.
You know, they can't shut off that voice in their head. And I think a lot of people's root issues as far as like, you know, most people that are have weight issues have some sort of underlying psychological issue from what I've found. It sounds terrible, but it's true. And a lot of people are afraid to sit still because they don't have to deal with reality. So I think getting quiet and meditating, in my opinion, is kind of like the body's reset. It's kind of like resetting your hard drive and kind of cleaning things out. It's scary because I remember when I first started trying to meditate, I literally, like I was there for a minute and it was the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life. Just to sit still. And now I can do it for a couple hours. You know, I even go up and use the float tank. But the amount of insight and the amount of just peace that I have when I do that, and if I'm on my meditation, and if I'm taking care of myself, I can come into the gym and I can train really, really hard.
You have a float tank at your gym?
I don't. I have to drive an hour and a half to get one. To do one. I wish I had a float tank. There in Kentucky, you have to have a public pool permit to get a, say that 10 times, the public pool permit to get a float tank. So I would love to get one here at the gym. If there's any venture capitalists listening right now that are in Lexington, I would love to for you to put a float tank in my gym and we can take the city on and find a way to get a float tank here.
So,
but I drive an hour and a half right now to go to one.
It's exclusively for the purposes of like meditation. Is that correct?
It's meditation on steroids. Yes.
Dude, I have been trying to get Power Athlete HQ to get a meditation tank for so long, and they say they don't have the budget for it, but it is.
Hey, Callie, I thought that's what you were recording.
Callie, what did we miss? We were installing a meditation tank in the gym.
I just moved, and so now you guys just throw one in there. I am fascinated with these things. So you have experienced the meditation tank, and like my first question is, how did you come to find that meditation was going to be such a big component to recovery? Did you come on that like on your own, or did someone recommend it? And number two, what is it like to be in one of those like those meditation tanks?
Well, when I first basically I ran myself into the ground for like 8 years, you know, like ephedra tablets, working long hours, working second jobs because I wouldn't curtail my spending. And I basically hit a wall. I got into a car wreck, and then about 4 weeks later, I ended up with ulcerative colitis, and I was always bleeding to death. And going to the bathroom every 3 hours and having blood come out of your ass is a very quick wake-up call to get you kind of going in the right direction. And I started listening to Rob Wolf. I started listening to a couple different shows, and I listened to a guy named Paul Check. And a lot of people think Paul's kind of fruity. But Paul was the first person that got it into my head, like, you know, I was always smart, like telling my clients you need to rest and all that, but I didn't really understand what rest was.
Hey, Jim, just take a step back. When you would go number two and look in the toilet, did you see blood? Like, what was your reaction?
Oh, my reaction was like, holy shit, and I didn't eat any beets, you know?
Yeah,
and
well, did I have a beet smoothie for lunch?
Pretty much. I mean, it was probably one of the scariest things I've ever encountered. And I mean, you try to sleep, and it literally every 2 hours, every 15 minutes, 2 hours, you're getting up and going to the bathroom. And it's just, dude, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. And, you know, they wanted to do surgery on me, and I refused. I did some research. I actually got my colitis under control through meditation. Nicotine gum, believe it or not, nicotine is 85% effective in calming a colitis flare-up. It's on PubMed. That's where I found it.
Is that why Rob Wolf is always on the nicotine gum? He's always got a sore ass?
Well, I guess. Well, I think Rob does it because he's a stimulant junkie like I am, and that's one of the safest stimulants there is nicotine. So, you know, it keeps both of us from driving.
From Rob going down his road of destruction with cocaine and hookers that he's always talking about.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of a managing a lesser of evil stress management strategy, I guess you might say. So I basically started looking out, you know, for information. I started doing a lot of reading, and I was like, I did not want to have a colostomy bag at, you know, how old was I? In my early 30s, I was like, I'd rather die. That might offend some people, but that's cool. I'm cool with that. But, you know, so I started looking out, and I listened to a guy named Paul Check, and he was talking about how the harder you work, the more you need to work in. And he was talking about doing Tai Chi and things like that so that you can recover from your training. What I was doing was just digging the hole deeper and overreaching. And because I was taking some performance-enhancing supplements at the time, I could really overreach, and that's something I think too that's not very transparent in the fitness industry is the amount of people that are using performance enhancing drugs and not being honest about it. And they're, you know, I'm training this and I'm doing that, but you know, the normal everyday people don't realize that a lot of them are using drugs to do it. And you know, even though I was on drugs, you know, my digestion was the weak thing that went. And so I had been pushing myself and, you know, not sleeping enough and working too hard. And eventually that's what gave out on me. You know, it's just like a car. If you drive three different cars at red line for an hour, you know, the Honda Civic might blow a rod, or maybe the tire blows up. The Audi's going to, something else is going to blow up, and the Ferrari, something else is going to blow up. So, and the Ferrari might not blow up because it's designed to drive really hard. You're just going to have to replace the brakes and tires, you know, and that's expensive. But, you know, so my digestion is what went bad in me. Bad nutrition. I was trying to, you know, I was at the time in powerlifting, going up a weight class was the answer to getting stronger. And I was trying to get up, you know, over 300 pounds, and I was eating, you know, three or four pizzas a week and, you know, just crazy stuff. And that's when everything came off the rails. And, you know, when you have that kind of slap in the face, sickness is a wonderful teacher, and it made me get really serious really fast. And I realized I had this, you know, I was spinning in my mind all the time. And, you know, Paul Check talked about meditation. So I sat down with an app called Brainwave, and I put it on calm reflection, calm relaxation. I started with 1 minute of just sitting quietly listening to this binaural beat stuff, and it just about killed me. And I slowly started figuring it out that, you know, I can't be driving around to Megadeth or I Hate God or whatever else I'm listening to all the time. And that I was an adrenaline junkie, and I needed to learn how to chill out. I needed to go fishing more, and I needed to do some things to put gas back in the tank. And it took me a long time to dig out of that hole, and I still struggle with it. You know, being a gym owner, it's hard to get that rest in. But that's where I realized that, you know, the more I meditated, the better job I did at work, the better, more pleasant person I was to be around. The less grudges I held, the more I was able to like forgive people and move on and not hold grudges. I think that's, resentment is something that a lot of, you probably will edit this out later, but you know, resentment is something that a lot of people struggle with, and that, you know, being angry with someone, only you really only hurt yourself. So meditation showed me a lot of that stuff and helped me kind of get through that point in my life where I could, you know, get healthy again and start going in the right direction.
That's great. And you experienced, I'm sorry, I'm stuck on this, and I promise if you can just give me like a brief answer, but you experienced the old meditation tank, and I mean, it changed your world in terms of like, it's sensory deprivation essentially. Yes. And you get to, are you literally like, floating, right? It's like,
yes.
You're sort of like at this ambient, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I can put my arms above my head in a full range of motion. My rib cage is lined up perfectly with my belly button. I can breathe perfectly. You know, it's perfectly dark. So it's like, you know, because I'm so on all the time coaching, it's the complete opposite. It's like being in a cave. And I wouldn't recommend it for someone who's just starting to learn how to meditate, because you literally will freak out the first time you go in there because you'll be just panicking because you're not used to being silent and there's no phone and all that stuff. But it's basically taking your meditation practice to the next level. And it, you know, decompresses your spine and all that magnesium gets soaked into your body so that you get that big magnesium dose. And most people are magnesium deficient. So it's a really awesome experience for people that have started meditating and want to take it to kind of the next level. And just being able to let go and just totally let go of everything. It's a very freeing and awesome experience once you get used to it. The first time, it usually takes you about a half an hour to settle down. But I literally, like, get in the tank, and I'm usually in for 90 minutes, and I literally just wake up, like, 5 minutes before I'm supposed to get out, and it doesn't even feel like I've been in there at all. That's how awesome it is. And
it's amazing.
Yeah, it is. And if you can relax and get into it, it's completely like nothing I've ever done before, and I highly recommend people at least try it once.
I'm going to do it. Let's talk a little bit about assessing athletes a little bit further. I know that you mentioned FMS as being one of your screening tools for pain. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything that you have sort of developed over time that is either unique to your training facility or things that you've incorporated from other coaches that you like to use to assess limiting factors within the athletes? I know that you talked on your podcast with Dan John, and when we had him on, he mentioned that he likes to use pharmacaries as a way to assess athletes and tensile mm-hmm. strength, and just it's just kind of a low hanging fruit for somebody who doesn't have any technical experience.
Awesome, yeah, it's very true. That's a great assessment tool, and I like to keep it simple, like Dan John. I use bear crawl. I'll get people in a bear crawl, and I'll tell them that they have a glass of water on their butt, and I'll have them crawl 5 yards back and forth about 6 to 8 times, and that tells me their cardiovascular condition, their ability to control their core, skipping. And most of the kids that come in here can't skip. I want to see toe touch, if they can touch their toes without hyperextending their knees, or they're like, look, I can touch my toes, but their knees are bent backwards. It's like, eh, big fail. You know, so, you know, stuff like that. And I mean, honestly, just from doing this for so many years, most of the athletes are at such a low level and their work capacity is so terrible that I just know that they're going to suck when they come in. I know that sounds terrible, but it's true.
I like that you said skipping, because we use that at the CrossFit Football Seminar quite a bit, and I will tell you what, it is ridiculous. The ipsilateral movement that we see, same side arm, same side leg going up, and just total, like, people not even knowing how or what a skip is, or not being able to skip in a straight line.
Or they're so tight while they're doing it. They're so flexed. It's like somebody's got like a Bambi bear in front of them.
Yeah.
And they're like, we're gonna shoot Bambi unless you skip perfectly. And they're just completely locked up.
Like,
you
know, mechanical.
It's they're using like that high threshold strategy to do something that should be done totally relaxed.
Yeah.
You should be able to skip. You should be able to like stand on one foot without having to clench your teeth and go into extension. So that's basically what we're looking at. We're looking at how they breathe. Are they coming in and they're like breathing through their neck? Is there, you know, are they have that big rib flare? We're looking for that. We're looking for zone of apposition, which is where the rib cage and the belly button line up. If they're stuck in extension, they got a big rib flare, that means we're going to have to do some exhale drills and get that down to get their core activated. Because you got someone that's jammed into extension, they're going to be using their spine for everything. We see a lot of kids that come in getting hurt weightlifting at schools because they load them up way too early, and they're jamming into extension to get their spine, either because their coach told them that's what they needed to do from powerlifting, or they just don't have a core, so they're using anything they can to get that stability.
When you talk about being an extension too, are you specifically, when you said the zone of apposition, and I assume you're referring to what can also be referred to as like a pelvic tilt.
Anterior pelvic tilt, yes.
Yeah, okay. We call that CrossFit girl butt.
Yeah, yeah. You can still not have anterior pelvic tilt and still have rib flare.
Yeah,
okay. If you want to look into this more, look into the Postural Restoration Institute. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of stuff with it's really in-depth, and the zone of apposition is the main thing I look at, rib cage and belly button together. Most people can't pull their belly button up, and then most people's ribs they're kind of stuck up. They call rib flare, and they can't exhale. So when you can't exhale, you're pretty much stuck in this state of inhalation, which is like super high alert state all the time.
And in case somebody is not familiar with what sort of risk that poses or even performance inhibition that poses. Can you just touch on, for any moron out there who's not sure whether this is like, you know, going to be a component, whether it's in training or on field, what sure. risk does that play?
Well, if you're stuck in real bad extension, you know, like some athletes are going to have extension. That's fine. We just want to make sure we don't push them further down that path. Like if Usain Bolt comes to me, of course he's going to have anterior tilt. Most sprinters do. I'm not going to like fix his posture unless he has pain. I'm not going to start doing agility work with Usain Bolt. Like if I did agility work with Usain Bolt, I would slow him down because he's built for a highly specialized activity, the 100 meter dash, straight ahead as fast as possible. If you've got people that are beginners especially and they're already stuck in extension and then you load them and they're using that extension, basically you end up jamming your spine together and over time you're going to have a higher risk of, you know, disc injuries, things like that. You're going to be in a bad position going overhead. You're going to be using that spine when you're going overhead instead of using your entire core as a unit. So you're going to increase your risk of disc injury or going overhead. You're also going to put your shoulder in a really bad position. We get pitchers that don't have any internal rotation, and it's because they're when you lay them on the ground, their low back is 2 inches off the floor. You know, they're like arched because that's how they've compensated. So all of a sudden you get them to blow their ribs down and exhale and do some different drills. All of a sudden they've got full internal rotation and we haven't stretched a thing. So a lot of it is just good position or bad position. If you're in a bad position, you're basically, and especially athletes that are really extended, like, you know, you're not going to be able to get an athletic position in very easily if you're really stuck in extension. So yeah. You want to make sure that we don't drive people down that path. And if I have someone who is in extension and it's not causing them any problems, I'm going to do more things like front squats and things like that so I don't drive them into extension even more. You know, I don't want to go so far down that path that it leads to dysfunction. And that really, as a strength coach, with your dealing with elite-level athletes, it's really all about managing dysfunction. Because if I fix a baseball player and I make his posture normal, he's not going to be able to throw baseball. You know?
Right.
So it's about keeping him from going so far down that road that he ends up with pain or dysfunction without eliminating his performance. It's kind of like working with a high-level athlete is kind of like walking a tightrope. You know, it's like you're kind of walking on that rope and you're hoping that you don't fall off. That's kind of how it works. And then, you know, with the beginner people, we want them to be in a good position, and that rib cage and belly button together, you know, with a circumferential expansion is the most efficient way the core works. And that's what's going to give you the most core activation, and that's going to protect your back. And so, and then looking into the stuff like, you know, like Stuart McGill talks a lot about that too, the circumferential expansion, and then realizing that certain athletes have certain limitations and certain things that make them better at certain sports. If you get on YouTube, you can look at Stuart McGill talk about different types of hips. You know, certain hips are made for squatting, certain hips are not made for squatting, and certain hips are made for going back and forth really fast, and certain hips are made for explosive rotation. You know, so looking at people and going, well, you know, this is the sport they've picked, but yeah, it doesn't really look like it's a good fit for them. And I think that's one of the big problems today too, is parents are trying to put kids into a specific sport at 4 and 5 without really realizing what they're going to develop into later on.
Yeah, this is all music to our ears. This is all not news, hopefully, to anybody who listens to the show. You're on point with a lot of our philosophies. And I did want to ask you, you know, can you remember a time in your 15-year coaching experience where you fucked something up, where you've had some issues with an athlete, and we've all had learning experiences, but we all try to like learn from each other. And can you think of any mistakes that you've made that you've learned from over time?
I think being a little too aggressive in the beginning. You know, as I've gotten older, I've realized that how little you have to do to get people better. Especially if you can take care, convince them to take care of themselves outside the gym. And then, of course, when I first started strength training, you know, the arch was it. You know, you arched for everything. You arched on the bench. You got that hard arch in your deadlift. You hard arched on the squat. And, you know, that's the way I taught things in the beginning of my career. And now I'm realizing, holy shit, that, you know, not only does that lead to back issues, but hip dysfunction and knee problems and all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, you do the best you can with the information you have at the time. And you learn and you look at new things and you go, how does that fit into my worldview? And, you know, that was a hard pill to swallow about 5 or 6 years ago, that a lot of the stuff that I was teaching people early on in my career was not optimal.
Yeah. Where do you see, just out of curiosity, where do you see strength and conditioning going? I mean, we've seen a lot of trends come in and out. As far as I'm concerned, there are still over 100,000 certified Jazzercise instructors, according to my research, which is legitimate. But I mean, just like not to make a joke, but there's a lot of trends in fitness, mm-hmm. and I'm just wondering if you think that if there's one on the horizon, or you know, where's your practice going? Mm-hmm. So.
I kind of like to be in the middle of the road. You know, I don't want to be too far on either extreme, but I think we've gone down this intensity. Exercise more, all you need to do is be more active. I think we've gone down that path of very long, you know, Biggest Loser, CrossFit, and a lot of people are not getting, you know, we still have more, you know, obesity is going up, all these sort of things. People are exercising more and things just aren't happening. So I think there's a big movement now for people taking care of themselves, meditation, that sort of thing. I think the pendulum's going to swing back the other way, but it's going to swing way too far. You know, all of a sudden, you know, stress is something we need, right? You know, I talk to people about stress all the time, but without stress, we don't adapt. As a strength coach, you're a stress management specialist. You're basically trying to figure out how much stress is necessary to make this person adapt, or how much lack of stress is necessary to get this person to adapt. You know, if you want to super compensate somebody, or if you want to, you know, peak somebody, you have to beat them up a little bit and then back off. But I think people are starting to talk about stress and how stress and all these different things. I think it's going to swing back the other way where people are going to start basically, you know, hey, we don't need to train hard. We don't need to do all these things. It's going to go back the other direction. And then, you know, eventually it'll swing back. And I always try to be somewhere in the middle. I mean, all our clients train hard. They train within their ability. They train with good movement. That's what I've always done to the best of my knowledge. And over time, I've improved things. But I think you're going to see, like, CrossFit gyms, if they're going to survive, they're going to have, like, a beginner like a program that basically when you come in and say, okay, I'm here, I want to train, what is your goal? Is your goal to look good and feel good? Well, here's your program. Is your goal to be in the CrossFit games? Okay, well, we need to assess you first, then we need to see if you move well, and then we can train you for the games, you know, based on your weaknesses, instead of just kind of throwing everybody into the, you know, we're just going to come out and everybody's going to do double unders and everybody's going to run around the building and jump on a box 100 times. So the people that are going to succeed are going to basically adapt their training to who they're training, because what's happened is the level of preparedness of the population has gone down dramatically, and the intensity and the training because of the internet has gone through the ceiling. I mean, people are trying to do things that are just, you know, insane when they don't have any base level. So the coaches that can come down, bring the level of coaching down to the level of the people where they're at, and then, you know, starting there and then building that base and foundation, then being able to adjust their training as that wave goes up and down according to where the person is and what's going on in their life, those are the people that are going to succeed in the long run.
Do you see the dad bod fad sticking around?
Oh, dude, I don't know. Our society is so weird. You know, we tend to normalize dysfunction. So I hope for my, you know, just for the sake of the country, that people get back to independence, self-care, self-responsibility. I highly doubt it, but, you know, people get back to taking care of themselves and doing what's right for them. I don't know. I hope so. I hope people don't buy into stuff like that and just be the healthiest version of themselves that they can be. Eat good food, sleep. You know, who cares what Men's Health think is the best body, or who cares what Victoria's Secret thinks is the best body? You know, be the healthiest version of yourself and let the chips fall where they may.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
Jim, so you said a couple of things that have really piqued my interest. One is you said everybody who walks through your door is a mess. And then later in the conversation you said something about parents putting their children into sports that they later might not develop well suited
they're
for.
They're just not well adapted for.
They're just not well adapted for it, yeah.
To play in the NBA.
Oh, yeah, or me trying to do pretty much anything that involves physical activity. But so what are parents to do then in terms of assessing young children? So I'm a parent of a 4-year-old, extremely active boy.
Yeah.
and he's playing stuff. And one of the things I try to do constantly is not have him sit down, right? Because all the evidence on sitting is, like, it just crushes you. Try to get him to move. Try to get him to move properly. But what can the average sort of the average parent do to help their kids not be as fucked up as the people who walk through your door?
Let them play. Get them outside. Let them make mistakes. Let them fall off stuff. You know, give them the ability to go out and learn on their own. Put them in as many sports as possible. Put them in gymnastics, not competitive gymnastics, but just general play gymnastics. Expose them to everything. Put them in swimming so they don't drown when they fall in a pool. Expose them to all sorts of different things. And then as they get older, let them gravitate towards what they like to do and then what their body is, you know, what their body tells them they should be doing.
I actually have a pretty good conversation with Rafael Ruiz, who's one of our coaches and a good friend of ours. And Raf and I always have theorized this idea of, like, you know, and I know people talk about it, but it's called like physical and athletic problem solving. That putting your kids at a young age in positions where they have to solve athletic problems.
Yes.
Like, for example, you know, just setting them up. Like, my little girl's always like, hey, Dad, can you help me get up there? I'm like, no, go get it yourself. And they'll find a way to, like, monkey their way up onto the counter or, you know, figuring out this problem solving. And I think we're so adept at wanting to, like, help our kids to do everything that we don't really force them to figure out these athletic problems or, more importantly, how to, like, kind of navigate different things. So
yep,
for
you're,
me...
You're dead on.
You know, and like, and then also you look at like hierarchy of athletes. I mean, what, you know, what skills, and I know Raf and I just actually had this conversation like 2 days ago, like the ability, like swimming in terms of horizontal orientation, something like gymnastics that has multiple different types of orientation. And then obviously something that teaches some form of like body control. Whereas, you know, I signed the girls up for Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So they have a 3 to 5 year old class and the girls are going to start taking that. Raf's got his little boy and, Filipino combat systems because he's Filipino and they do Eskrima. So his little boy is 3 and is now has his own like little rubber knife and is working on all these different death strikes. So
awesome.
But like, you know, I think the problem is that, you know, parents are just so apt to just, well, you know, sports will figure it out, but they'll figure it out in recess where the parents aren't doing anything active. And we know from, you know, hundreds of years of research that kids learn by watching their parents do the movements. So like bring the kids to the gym and like, you know, like I always love seeing the picture of Playtech and his boys or his son and all of his son's friends, like trying to wrestle him at the gym. I mean, that actually makes my heart warm, but like that type of situation. And I think what happens is that, you know, we're seeing not only the reason the kids are broken is because the parents are broken and it's a broken set of movement patterns that's going, you know, 2 and 3 generations up. And I think all we're seeing now is like the, you know, all of our dysfunction being played out to us and kids. I mean, you know, and you guys know this as fathers. I mean, all of a sudden your kid develops something and you're like, where did that come from? And it kind of gives you introspectively to look at yourself.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, people always ask me, like, how do I get my wife to buy into this or how do I get my husband to buy into this? I'm like, lead by example. And that's so true. And that's where I got back to before talking about individual responsibility. This is not going to change from the top down. It's going to change from the bottom up when people are like, we don't like the way this is going and we need to take, you know, take responsibility for ourselves and fix it. You know, just like I had to do with my health, like I destroyed myself. So I had to take responsibility to fix myself. And the same thing is going to have to happen, you know, from the grassroots up. And that's the unfortunate thing is a lot of the programs that are set up like these AAUs and these different, you know, baseball leagues and stuff like that are set up to profit and basically, you know, that they're not the best interest of the kids isn't at heart. And so things are going to have to change from the grassroots up. And John, you're absolutely right. It's just a reflection of the home, you know, and that's unfortunate that hopefully more people will wake up.
I will say too, you know, just in case anyone was wondering, it's not just fathers with little boys. Every single night after our family ate dinner, I would move the coffee table out of the way and my dad would wrestle me and for probably like a good hour and we would just wrestle and play fight and stuff. But that was like seriously like a nightly routine. And I only now can I appreciate like the body awareness and having to really fight against resistance and like the, I don't know, it was fun, but it was just also, it had an element of like athleticism and engagement and just, you know, we weren't just like sitting there watching TV. It was game time, you know?
Yeah. What's interesting is all the new psychological research shows that that's beneficial not only for the child, but it's as, if not more, beneficial for adults who are undergoing a lot of stress at work, life, et cetera. Play, in addition to what you were talking about earlier, meditation, play is one of the best stress relievers on the planet, and adults just don't play anymore. I see kids outside of my front yard, and I'm the only one that they're tackling because the other guys are on their smartphones.
Sure. Yeah, Steve, I listened to a podcast recently about adult play and how you can incorporate it more in your regular life. And I think I told Luke about this, about how you know, the one big proponent for adult play had had he and his buddies all dress up in blue collared shirts, like polo shirts and khaki pants, and they all went to Best Buy and just walked around, and people began to ask them questions where things were, and the Best Buy crew just thought it was hilarious. And so they were all giving instruction and stuff, and it was just like an adult form of maybe not physical play, but it was just an element of kind of like taking yourself mentally away from whatever stressors were in your life and doing something that had absolutely no result whatsoever. So it's the idea of doing something where the result is, it doesn't matter. It's insignificant.
Yeah, it's like costume play. My boy comes home from school every day and reminds me that he's either Captain America or Superman, depending upon whatever day it is. And like he, at some level, he kind of believes that he's a superhero, and it takes you out of reality. It's very similar in terms of the neurological processes when you do that kind of character play. It's very similar to the effects on the brain that meditation has, because it alleviates that attention, your brain's attentional network, to what's happening in the past or what's happened in the past, what's going to happen in the future. Instead,
right,
you're in the now. You're never more living in the moment than you are when you're in a character.
Right.
You know,
right.
Steve, I'm sure your son will find it a little weird that he, you know, I mean, I appreciate him dressing up as a superhero. Does he mind that you cross-dress?
John, that was a private conversation.
No, but I'll on a serious note, I mean, it's not very serious, but actually one of the most therapeutic things for me is actually coloring. So my daughters, everywhere we go, we bring them coloring books, and I sat down and I just grabbed the crayons and I'll start to color with them. Now my wife actually got me my own coloring book, so I have like a dinosaur's coloring book, and then I got my own crayons now,
so,
too.
So one thing that people don't know about John, actually, is one of the things that I learned about him that I thought was pretty fascinating was that he was very interested in pottery and potting, and he actually has some mugs at the office that he made, I think, when he was in college. And then what I noticed over time is that he plays with a lot of putty at his desk, and so I think it was for Christmas, I got you a thing of putty because yours was basically looking like a cesspool of like just like disgusting hand filth. And so I got you some putty, and you literally play with it every waking moment. Like, I mean, nonstop.
Kelly, he worked hard to get all those germs in that whole putty.
That putty is so disgusting. I use it to stick things on the wall, so I'll put like pictures up with it. It's so bad.
Yeah,
but, I'll be sure to bring you a coloring book in October, John.
Like, I'm telling you, dude. It was so funny. Like, my wife busted out the coloring stuff, and she hands it to the kids and hands them my own and my own little box of crayons. And I was like, I got my own coloring books. And my daughters kind of like looked at it, and they were like kind of scoffed. And then like a few seconds later, they were like, hey, what is yours? You know. And then they started trying to rip pages out of mine. And I'm like, hey, this is Dad's coloring book. There's no scribbling all over mine. I color inside the lines. So it's it's been pretty good, and the thing that's been nice is we get to make projects at home for the kids, and we just went to parent-teacher conferences, and my their teacher was like, have you been helping Jamie with some of her coloring projects? I'm like, no. I'm like, who? What dad colors?
So, you are – you can't get on Steve Playtech about any sort of feminist roles he might be playing because you're on the edge, my friend.
No, I think you know what, the day that you're too good to color, then I think something's wrong with you. And I have noticed something, and I wonder if this is a California thing, but people around here seem like...
I'll tell you.
It probably is a California thing, but people around here are very like this kind of like I'm the most important, everything about me and my family is most important and at the expense of everybody else. And so it's pretty interesting as all these parents are sitting there just immersed in themselves, and they look over and they see me coloring. We went to dinner last night, and it happened. So
nobody's gonna say shit to you either. You know, nobody can even see the crown in your giant knit.
I did have a 75-year-old woman give me a stink eye yesterday, and then give me the finger. And,
no way. Were you driving? Yeah.
No, I was actually backing out of a parking spot, and like the car next to me parked so close, I had to take a couple stabs to get out in my truck. And obviously, she had to wait. And so, of course, she hangs her old, like, she kind of looked like a English bulldog face out the window and is giving me stink eye. And I looked over and I was like, hey, I'm trying to back out. And doesn't say anything, just instantly gives me the finger. Wow. And I, like, looked at her and I was like, every ounce of me wanted to go rip her door off. And
you know what you need is a little meditation. Perhaps a meditation pod would do you some good.
Yeah, it probably would. Actually, I just booked an appointment for Luke and I because there's one right on Harbor about 3 miles to the gym. We might go over there right now.
You got to be fucking kidding me.
Yeah, it's called the Newport Float, and it's literally right on Harbor, right down the street from the gym. And
you could even ride a bike there.
Yeah, you could ride a bike if you had to. And it's a 90-minute session, and you float in like 1,000 pounds of like Epsom salt, so you just float in there for 90 minutes.
Wow, just dig the knife a little deeper. Thanks, John. Well, let's get back to our special guest. I do want to just touch on briefly. I know we have listed here that you roomed with Jim Wendler back in the day. Yes. Definitely a few questions about that, but I would like to say that I think it's better to phrase that Jim Wendler roomed with you as you are our special guest. So Jim Wendler was lucky enough to have you as a roommate. What was that like, number one? And number two, what kind of movies did you guys watch? Did you guys ever have, like, movie night, date night?
God almighty.
And not only that, Callie, did Jim influence your musical appreciation at all?
I reckon he did, based on your music list.
Yeah, I'm sure I had one of the most unique music lists you've probably ever gotten. Jim is a good friend, and he's a very interesting – he can be one of the angriest – people I've ever met in my life. At the same time, could be one of the nicest. I was Jim was living in a one-bedroom studio apartment when I crashed his house, and I was only supposed to stay for like a week and ended up staying for like 8 months, so I'm surprised he even answers my text messages anymore. But, you know, the best beginner coach possible, that pretty much came from Jim Wendler. Jim is very well read. He's very intelligent, very articulate, and he always loves to play devil's advocate. So anytime I need to talk to somebody to kind of shake my head up a little bit, and Jim will always tell me when I'm full of shit as well, which is what a true friend is for. Jim's into all sorts of crazy movies. He really likes to read, but he's into some really weird shit that I just can't talk about. But literally really weird shit, if you get what I'm talking about. Shit.
I get it. I get it.
So, Jim, one time we were in Kroger, which is like kind of like Safeway.
Two chicks, one Wendler.
Oh, my God.
One day we were in Kroger, and we walk up, and this lady, you can tell she's having a really bad day, and Jim's all dressed up like, you know, the typical Wendler beard, you know, the whole deal. And Jim says to her, how are you today? Are you doing okay? And she said, not really. And he says, it's okay. It's going to get better. And he goes into this whole spiel about everything's going to be fine and you look really nice today. And I just looked at him and was like, what the hell? And he looked at me and he goes, you know, it's always good to be nice to people because you never know. You might be the one person that keeps them from blowing their fucking brains out. Wow. And I was like, okay. But that's Jim, you know? Wow. So Jim is I really enjoyed rooming with Jim. He's a really good person, but he's very his musical selection definitely rubbed off on me a little bit. I threw a little bit of the Southern Sludge into my selection. He definitely helped me go down the right path as far as focusing on fundamentals and not getting too distracted by all the latest bells and whistles. He got me into powerlifting. You know, I wouldn't be in Lexington now if it wasn't for Jim. So I really owe I was between jobs, and then I came out to Lexington just to help Jim with his first powerlifting meet, and I ended up staying in Lexington for, God, I've been here since 2001, so 13, 14 years now, and so I really owe you know, everything where I'm at in my career right now, you know, to Jim getting me going in this direction. So Jim kind of started this whole thing for me.
So if you could watch one inspirational or just, I don't know, entertaining movie for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Well, I like Patton by George C. Scott and The Hunt for Red October, or probably I've watched them probably 10,000 times. I'm kind of a huge military dork historian. You know, one of my dog's name is Rommel, and the other dog's name is Patton. So I have a huge appreciation for military history, and so those are probably my two that I've probably watched 10,000 times each.
Wow, that's great. I love Hunt for Red October. I have seen Patton probably maybe twice, but I've definitely seen Hunt for Red October every time it, like, hits TBS. I'm like, I don't know. I can't not watch it. It's so good.
The character of, like, George Patton, the person, is what fascinates me the most because he's such a – he's a lot like Jim. He's two extremes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just such an intelligent guy, such a passionate guy. A very caring guy, but it's just such a dichotomy of people. People like that kind of fascinate me. So Patton is one of my favorite historical figures.
Fantastic. Well, listen, where can people go to find out more information on you, what you do, your gym, and your training philosophies?
Jimlaird.com, G-Y-M. You can see what I kind of did there. Mm-hmm. That's the gym website. I'm going to be doing a podcast on Kiefer's Body IO Radio. I'll be getting that going again soon. I'm doing a seminar in my hometown. I haven't been home since 2001, Edmonton, Alberta, or 2002, with Dean Somerset. I'll be doing that. You can look up on deansomerset.com. You can look that up if you want to come out to that. In October, John, myself, Matt Lalonde, Rob Wolf, Dave Warner, who am I leaving out, John? Am I leaving anybody? Charles Mayfield. We're going to be doing a seminar in Atlanta, which is going to be pretty awesome. I mean, I would pay to go to that just to hang out, not alone get to
speak. What date is that? Because I was not privy to that.
I don't know the exact date, but it's in October and it's in Atlanta. And it's I am so fired up to be a part of that. I mean, just the group of people that are involved in that is – oh, I mean, I'm humbled and surprised to be a part of it. It's pretty awesome. I'm really looking forward to that week.
What is that event called?
The Cube Summit? Is that it, John? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, it's called the Cube Summit, and it's like the way it all kind of started was Charles and Rob and I have gotten together every couple times a year for the last bunch of years. Last time we drove up to Reno to hang out with Rob because they just had their most recent daughter, and then our kids are all the same age, so we are looking for excuses to kind of get together and hang out, and then include the circle. And so Charles has a big family farm over in Tennessee that he invited us all to come out and go hunting and just get together with all the families and, you know, just make a memory. And he thought it would be great if we could, you know, have everybody in town, if we could have kind of a roundtable summit, you know, meet up of these various different people that are all our friends. And, you know, Jim is, you know, new to our kind of clique, and we were excited to have him. So Charles hit me up and said, hey, you know, I'm thinking of bringing everybody in, and we can, you know, do this summit and have some fun, and then be able to go out to the farm and hunt and sit around and, you know, eat and drink some moonshine. And as you guys know, Charles is a phenomenal cook, and you got Rob and then Dave Warner. And I went hunting with Rob and Dave Warner last year. And so it's just, a good time that we're going to do this fall, and it'll be a great opportunity to get all the kids together and just have a blast. So I'm pretty excited about it. And hopefully, if there's any proceeds, I can donate my money to Wade's Army, which is really the deal for me. And then also, I don't necessarily know what I'm going to speak about, but I'd like to definitely get up and talk something about, you know, athletic development and, you know, the type of things that you can do to increase performance for not only yourself, but the kids. And, you know, I know Matt's coming in to speak on nutrition, and, you know, Dave Warner, former Navy SEAL, and he and Rob started the first CrossFit affiliate. And obviously, you know, Rob will probably get up and talk about, you know, nicotine abuse and politics. And then, Jim will talk about, various choices for men to make when trying to select high heels for, you know, for men in size 13. So it'll be good. Playtech, you should definitely check out that section on high heels.
Oh my God.
Check it out because it's in my backyard.
So, but no, it's gonna be awesome, and I think we're gonna have the opportunity to go hunt a little bit. So, and then I'm on an email thread, so I just shot these guys those pictures of those big ass hogs I shot, and we've been kind of trading around some stuff. So it'll be good. We'll have a great opportunity to get out in the woods and fuck around a little bit.
Wow. John, well,
John, do you prefer like a spike heel or more of like a platform, like a broad platform heel?
John's a wedge guy.
You know, I'm into like more like what are those big clunky Steve Madden shoes?
Steve Madden.
Oh my God.
Yeah, you don't know Wolf of Wall Street, Callie?
I've seen it. I don't know, man. When you started talking about high heels, you sort of lost me. You guys have more terms for it than I was aware of, so I try to avoid them at all costs.
What are you talking about? I've seen you all hookered up, and you know.
You have not seen me. You have never seen me in high heels.
I think I have.
No.
More of like a horseshoe type of guy.
It's like seven horseshoes all welded together.
There it is. I got small feet, okay? It's not my fault. And I tend to prance around when I go from place to place, so.
Keep talking.
Well, I think that officially does it for all the pertinent information. Jim, is there anything?
Like, I'm cutting all this shit out.
Yeah, Jim, is there anything else that you want to add? Any other resources you want to touch on for people?
Not that I'm aware of. You probably want to check out the Postural Restoration Institute. Make sure you are well rested before you go there, because it will bend your brain in 10 different directions.
Got it.
And make sure that you don't drive yourself off into a cliff after you visit the site, because it will bend your brain immensely. Luckily, I have a very smart physical therapist that works here at the gym that could decipher that stuff for me and figure out how to make it applicable to our population. But I just wanted to thank you guys for making my afternoon. What an awesome time this was. And it's always good to laugh and to talk shop with people that are passionate about what they do. And I don't get to do that very often. That's one of the reasons I'm looking forward to October.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you on. Thanks for joining us, and we definitely look forward to recapping after the summit that you guys are doing in October. That'll be a fun time to recap and figure out exactly who wore what, apparently. So, all right, guys, that's it for Power Athlete Radio. Bye.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
Thanks for your time.
Now it's time for you to empower your performance. If you want to learn more about Jim and his upcoming seminars, head to his website, jimlaird.com. That's GYMLAIRD.com. Stay tuned to hear more about the October Meeting of the Minds, aka the Cube Summit, in Atlanta, Georgia. Don't forget to swing by our online store at shop.powerathletehq to rock the latest Power Athlete apparel, including the new Eat the Week shirt. Join us next week when our guest will be Rob Maximus McDonald. The former MMA champ now helps run the online training resource JimJones.com. Find out why he thinks having a dad bod is indicative of a culture that is simply okay with settling. And because it's topical, I leave you with this quote from General George S. Patton. It's the unconquerable soul of a man, not the nature of the weapon he uses, that ensures victory. Until next week. Bye!